Thank you for downloading this episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. To get more episodes and explore other SDN and network automation resources, visit sdn.ipspace.net.
In June 2017, we concluded the Building Next Generation Data Center online course with a roundtable discussion with Andrew Lerner, Research Vice President Networking at Gartner, and Simone Richard, Research Director Data Center Networking at Gartner. This podcast is the first half of that discussion. The second half will be published in the next episode. Also, don't forget to check the other content available in the online course at ipspace.net/DC. Hope you'll enjoy the discussion. Good morning, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the very last session of Spring 2017 Building Next Generation Data Centers online course. Today, we have two very special guests, Andrew Lerner and Simone Richard. I hope you got your name right.
Yes.
They're both working with Gartner, and believe it or not, they're both my heroes. Andrew became my hero when he wrote the Gartner report saying long distance vMotion is stupidity in way more diplomatic terms. And if I remember correctly, he was like the first one with some real authority saying this doesn't make sense. Whereas before we were just, you know, bloggers yammering how this is really crazy. And Simon became my hero when he wrote that fantastic report comparing NSX and Cisco ACI. Even though they work for Gartner, they are great networking engineers, and I was totally delighted when they figured out how to get on this course, even though they work for Gartner. And Andrew, I think there is something you have to say before we start, right?
Yeah, thanks, Ivan. Yeah, even though we work for Gartner to keep the lawyers happy, what we discuss today doesn't necessarily represent Gartner. It's our experiences both inside and outside of Gartner.
Now for the real intro. What are you guys doing and how did you come to Gartner and what is it that you're doing at Gartner?
Sure, yeah. So this is Andrew Lerner. I am a research analyst. I've been with Gartner for about 4 years and I cover network infrastructure. So that's anything typically layer three, layer two down, that goes into the data center, the WAN campus network. Prior to Gartner, I was on the enterprise networking side. So I built, designed, operated large enterprise networks for more than 15 years.
And I'm Simal Rishaga. I've been also for Gartner for 4 years and I cover data center networking, but also cloud networking. And these days I also cover container networking. In fact, even a little more. I cover what I call infrastructure agility or API-driven infrastructure. So everything that has API, whether it's network storage, servers, orchestration, I do cover that. Before joining Gartner, I was an architect in a Fortune 5 company, the principal chief network architect. And I kept like proposing design and architecture to executives, and it always asked me, what does Gartner think? So after a while, I got angry. I said, okay, let me join these guys so I don't have this question.
So it became now, so this is what Gartner thinks.
Yes. Yeah, let me tell you what Gartner thinks.
That's a good one. So the agenda we have on this slide is what they proposed based on what I wrote in the course description, which was really based on the reports that they wrote in the last few years. So let's start with the current state of the enterprise networking.
Yeah, sure. It's funny because I left the enterprise network side as a practitioner 4 years ago, and I think I left at a good time because it is hard these days in the enterprise. The business wants faster, cheaper, and good. They don't want to pick two, and they have more options. So there's that going on. There are the adoption of cloud, IoT, hyperconverged, containerized, all these things that are coming at us that are impacting the network. And there's new networking technologies. Networking innovation is happening faster. If you just on the WAN alone, if you think we had routers and WAN op for a decade or so, and now it's SD-WAN and virtualized CPE. So this is overlaid with the fact that there are now new ways to work with teams, with whether it's DevOps or if you buy into bimodal. And then on top of that, if you think about it, if your company is moving to SaaS or infrastructure as a service, portions of your network responsibility are being outsourced. You know, amidst all this, the traditional responsibilities remain. I don't talk to very many clients at all that are outsourcing their entire network infrastructure and closing data centers. So you have lots of the traditional responsibilities remain. And this is overlaid with flat budgets. We're not getting more people and more money. And people, the business still calls IT and blames the network when the SaaS app is slow. So it's an overarching theme of more with less. Meanwhile, this isn't necessarily happening at the hyperscalers. Facebook and Google don't have the same set of challenges of the enterprise, so the gap is actually growing. So it's difficult times being a network practitioner, particularly in the enterprise. And as a result, when we talk to our clients, one of the top things we tend to hear, I would bucket them into like three or four categories. There's an overarching theme of, I need to be more agile. The network is a long pole in the tent. I need to have better connectivity to the cloud. Help, I hate my WAN. And what about this new technology? Is it real? Is it hype? That's what I would describe at a high level as the current state of enterprise networking.
So you mentioned innovation in networking. And of course, the vendors claim that there has been no innovation for the last 20 years. But now that they have this cool new product, there is innovation there again. So what do you see as useful innovation in networking? What are the things that appeared in the last few years and make enough sense that they might stay for a while?
Myself, I think it's the biggest change in networking. It's not SDN, whatever SDN means. It's the advent of APIs for network device and the ability to orchestrate a network, to manage multiple devices at once. I think this is going to be the most important thing. And that's how you can increase your agility and realize, you know, a real network treated as a system with reacts in real time, you know, based on events, which acts on the outcome. So this is really what people are trying to get to. They're trying to abstract, you know, the network requirements in higher level terms and then use APIs to push this configuration to the device. I think for me, that's what's the most important change in the network. And SDN is one way to do that. There's other ways, but I think that's the most important thing, the network becoming programmable. And programmable is more than automation. Automation is like day zero configuration in my mind. You need orchestration and also you need day two programmability and be able to act on the outcomes. So configuration management for all the device, day zero, some orchestration to create services. And then after that, being able to react on outcomes. Most of the innovation, apart from the hardware innovation, for example, 25 gig lanes and that kind of stuff, I think this is what's more important and that's what will transform networking, especially for the enterprise.
Then, Andrew, you also mentioned the data centers and move into the cloud. Now, I know that this depends totally on where you are, whether it's US or the rest of the world, but probably you're seeing more move into the cloud in US versus what the rest of the world is doing. So how much do you see customers moving production workloads into the cloud? And how much of that is well thought out versus random cloud bursting?
Thanks for adding the second wrinkle onto that. But I would say that probably 80% of the client interactions I have, there's some component of move to the cloud or cloudified the infrastructure. Even Office 365 as a perfect example is a move of workload to the cloud, even though it is SaaS. So it's pervasive. And I do cover primarily US, but I cover Western Europe as well, just because of the hours I operate. So I would say in my calls, which are US and European centric, there is at least 80% of folks are having to make adjustments to their network to adapt to the cloud. Now to your second question, is this haphazard and random, or is this planned strategy? I'd say it's a mix. It's a relatively unhealthy mix of haphazard and CIO sets a cloud-first strategy or line of business picks an app that they really, really like and goes forward with. But there are a good number of organizations out there that have put together a pretty good architecture around adopting cloud. So So I don't think it's as haphazard as it was 2-3 years ago, but it still has a ways to go to get where the network is prominently included in the discussions early on, because that's frankly just not happening yet.
But it happens more and more, and I think Office 365 is driving a lot of that. So I have more and more calls in the last years. And 2 years ago, my number one call was ECI against NSX. And now is, how do I have Office 365, what should I do? So they need to re-architect the network because of cloud consumption, because the workloads are not all in the data center. So this is becoming very, very important. And people are starting to look at all the options, what they can do for the wide area network, including from the transport layer. Should I use the internet? Should I decentralize my internet? Should I distribute my internet everywhere? If I do that, what do I do for security? Or should I try to bypass the internet completely and use something like Direct Connect or Express Route meet in a colocation? So this is one of the biggest questions I have. And moving to the cloud, one of the reasons people move to the cloud again is because it's a lot of enterprises have cloud-first strategy, so the net new application, there's more than 50% going to the cloud. Even for the older application, the legacy application, just the fact, especially from a business unit point of view, they think IT is too slow and they think it's going to be much faster in the cloud, but sometimes they don't really think it through. But regardless if they move to the cloud or they stay on-prem in a data center, you still have to manage the SLA. You still have to operationalize what's in the cloud. And then there's a problem of the SaaS. I mean, all the SaaS are different. So how do you optimize the network for all the SaaS? Are they all like one-off solution? So this is the kind of questions we do have with the cloud. Cloud bursting for me is kind of a pipe dream. Or even there's a lot what we call multi-cloud. But multi-cloud is some enterprise have some workloads in Amazon, some workloads in Azure, but we don't really see workload across both of them, or in very rare instance.
Yeah, now that you mentioned these various access methods into the cloud, I see people using Direct Connect, for example, when they want to extend their data center or where they want to guarantee the bandwidth, for example, for database synchronization between their data center in the cloud. Do you also see them using, for example, it's not Direct Connect, whatever Microsoft is calling it?
Express Route.
Thank you. For Office 365.
In fact, it's funny. Microsoft stopped recommending the users of Office 365. Years ago, or even a year ago, they would say, yes, you can have a Direct Connect for Office 365. But now they're trying to convince people not to use Express Route to Office 365. They recommend using the internet. And they have DNS, Anycast address that you can subscribe to that service is when you go to Office 365 over the internet, you will enter the Microsoft network as close as possible where you are. Even if your mailbox is in Chicago and you end up being in Hong Kong, then you enter Microsoft network in Hong Kong. So that's really the way to do it. And one of the reasons is a lot of the service in Office 365, they were built from the internet. Even if you try to use Express Route with Microsoft, first you need a public IP address for Office 365. So that means that you want to use MPLS to go to Office 365, then you have to use Microsoft public IP address in your routing, you know, in your MPLS network or your private network. And they change all the time, so it's not very well. It's kind of very clunky, not very elegant. And then there's services that only use the internet in Office 365. So it's not really fit for Express Route. So now Microsoft has made a statement that they prefer you to use the internet directly. And it's creating a lot of, people are angry because of that, because there are people who move to Express Route and they realize it doesn't really work. It works well for Azure. If you have workload in Azure, there's no problem. But for Office 365, people are now moving more to the internet.
The other thing that I'm always worried about, and so it would be nice to see what your customers are doing, is if you're moving some of the real compute workload into the cloud, not offloading Office to Microsoft, how do you handle data? Do you access the data that sits in your data center, or do you replicate the data into the cloud, or do you just split the workload and some things run in the cloud only and some things run in your data center only?
Well, in general, people try to have their data closer to the workload. Years ago, people were very afraid of the cloud. They even went all the way back to their firewall on-prem when they move across zones, but they kind of stopped doing that. I think now people are moving their data closer in Amazon. People who are worried of multi-cloud have been locking. They also use colocation hubs, like something like Equinix, and they would put like a filer there and put their data using ExpressRoute and Direct Connect, for example. If that's the concern, they would put their data there. In fact, you can run workloads, AMI in Amazon, and have your storage being in Equinix, for example. So we see people inquiring about that. It's not that there's not a lot of adoption, but as people move to multi-cloud, especially if they start moving in the IoT world, where they might have multiple IoT platforms and there'll be a lot of data collected, you really want your data to be in the cloud provider, then you kind of have a locking that cloud provider. So they're trying to find ways where the data sits. Is it in a data center? Is it in the edge? Or is it maybe the edge now become like in a colocation hub? And in fact, it might end up even being a data services at some point where you just have a colocation hub provided as ExpressRoute and Direct Connect offering data services to create data lakes. And I say that, you know, with a smile because I don't really know what it is. Nobody does.
Now that you mentioned colocation, do you see people building new data centers that they own, or do you see them deploying new stuff in colo locations so that they don't have to own the building and cooling and power and all that stuff?
The general trend that I see in my calls is a desire to reduce the physical footprint that we are responsible for. And whether that is moving workloads to the cloud, whether that is using more efficient technologies to maximize your current space, whether it's virtualization or containerization, or whether it's using a colo or MNS. So I see an increasing desire to reduce physical footprint of what I'm responsible for, which means more stuff in the public cloud, IaaS, more stuff in colo.
In fact, we see a shrinking of data center just because there's more powerful computers. The rack are more and more dense, and there's a lot of stuff in the cloud. So because of that, we have more question about shrinking a data center than expanding it. But in some case, there's a decision to be made. Should I, for example, in time you do an acquisition, an M&A, that you might want to have to build a new data center. But really, it's more about consolidating and shrinking than building new data center. Most of my question.
And finally, going back a little bit, you mentioned the big cloud providers like Google and Facebook. And there's this mantra of Giphy or Google infrastructure for everyone else. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so you asked the question and then Simone answered it and then we went off. But that was actually going to be my answer because the question you asked is where do you see the innovation in networking? And I would argue that the innovation in networking in recent years has actually come from these large hyperscalers and large web scalers around how they operate, right? Dogged automation, ruthless standardization, scale out commodity component. The way they operate, you know, they have a 25,000-to-1 user or administrator to server ratio in the enterprise is 100-to-1. And I'm not saying that every enterprise can go do what Google does. In fact, I would say probably 90% to 90% of what they do can't be replicated in the enterprise because of either lack of scale, lack of available resources, et cetera, et cetera. But the 5% to 10% that is applicable, we should be copying. And maybe that moves us from a ratio, server to administrator ratio of 100-to-1 to 250-to-1. We might not get to that 25,000-to-1, but that's in many cases, a culture change, a technology change, but there are absolutely principles from the web scalers that can be applied in the enterprise that, quite frankly, are not applied in any substantial degree in the mainstream.
But it's a big culture change. And if you read about these concepts of SRE, system reliability engineers of Google, there's a lot of interest in that field and operation that transforming to do more automation. You still have the same requirements you have to fulfill, like availability, reporting, capacity management. You still need to do this function, but you do them differently and you automate whenever you can. In Google, they don't want you to spend more than 50% of your time resolving tickets. They want to make sure you spend more than 50% of your time automating process. So this is a big culture change. And in classical enterprise, it's very difficult to okay, I'm going to start thinking about automating our process, making our process better so we move faster, because as soon as you get an outage, then you're in trouble. So there's no incentive to do that. So this whole concept of the most important thing is the mean time between failure is important kind of put a dent into the whole story. Enterprise have to realize, yes, it's okay to fail sometimes as long as you can recover fast. And this is what they are doing. So it's a very different, like, the network always has to be up. In fact, it's extremely difficult to say, okay, let's move to agility. Let's provision faster. I want the network to be more agile, like servers are. I want it to be like VMware. I want to create a VM, move it around. At the same time, you can never be down. This really doesn't work. Everything has to change. On top of that, Google has a lot of, you know, they have a choice between the best engineer coming out of the best school every year. So it doesn't compare to a classical enterprise.
Anything else you would like to add to this one before we move forward?
So, you know, for me, when we talk about applying kind of the web scale principles, and Simone's right, culture is the issue. We refer to this, you know, overcoming this current culture that enterprise networking teams have of this notion of incrementalism. I would argue that's probably the number one challenge that the enterprise network has to overcome. It's this mentality of that I can do what I did last year. I can get 5%, 10%, 15% better this year and I'll be fine. It's worked for years. And that very much did match the pace of innovation and the pace of business change in networking. Sure, networking wasn't perfect, but it was good enough for many, many years. But what we're finding now is that this incrementalism mentality does no longer suffice in many instances. So it's that whole notion of what's tactically right, right? That incremental change is often strategically wrong. So during periods of stability, a preference for incremental changes is fine. It can limit risk, but you can miss out during periods of disruption and change. And in many cases, as a result, your risk aversion will stifle innovation. So this is, again, rooted in culture. As Simone said, you get fired for outage, and we've been indoctrinated into this culture of risk aversion, which has led to low degrees of automation that we see, siloed thinking, less risk taking. And the ultimate irony or catch-22 here is that if you constantly make incremental change, you end up taking on more technical debt. You accrue more technical debt, which adds fragility to the infrastructure, which actually reduces availability, which is what led to the incrementalism in the first place. So it's about managing risk versus avoiding risk at all costs. And again, this is hard. It's easy to talk about these concepts. It's extremely difficult to go in the enterprise and effectively make changes to do it, because a lot of it is rooted in culture, and overcoming this culture is hard. It takes people, process, technology, but we have to reward networking teams differently, look at different metrics, reward people for the things they automate, reward people for removing complexity, you know, have a different way to look at new projects. So that's just, you know, top-down rewarding and the KPIs we measure.
Now, Ed made a really good comment saying with Google or Amazon Web Services or Azure, networking is one of their core products, whereas with enterprises, it's just a supporting function like plumbing or basic hygiene. Mm-hmm. So with their business case being completely different than enterprise business case, how do you persuade an enterprise to start treating the IT in general as something that can bring them advantage instead of just a support function that generates expenses?
No, he's absolutely right. And the mentality that I would take into this isn't that I don't have the resources or the business model of a Google or Amazon, so this isn't for me. The mentality I would take into it is, hey, let's say 98% of what they do doesn't apply. But let's look at the 2%, let's find the 2% of low-hanging fruit that does apply and apply it. So even though it's a different business model, different resources, different scale, there are things that they do that we can emulate. Now, how do you convince the business at the higher level is always a challenge. And I always say, pick a pilot project, pull it off, demonstrate the value to the business. Because in many cases, the organizations that are saying, how do I get the business to justify this type of mentality? Those are often the same people that are saying the business is pushing me to be faster, to be more agile. So it's part of the answer to that conversation of how are we more agile? How can we reduce the time to market to produce services so that the business can run this marketing campaign next week versus, 3 weeks to get the infrastructure up? So that's my answer to that.
And one way to do that is to have the network actively participate, especially if you're moving into DevOps, having a network participate in a DevOps team and starting to use DevOps tools like Ansible, Puppet Chef, or SaltStack, and all the way to Jenkins to configure the network, to make the network a part of that old CI/CD pipeline and show value that way. And people realize, the network is not just a bunch of people we call and we have to set up a meeting to get an IP address, and it takes 2 weeks to get a VLAN. You sit down with them and you're able to treat a network really as code and show value that way. Because one of the big things that's happening in general are the line of business and the app dev people are circumventing a network. They either go to Amazon because it's too slow on-prem, or even for ADCs, load balancer, they say, I don't want to have to call the IT to get a new VIP and F5. Why don't I just use a HAProxy and Nginx? It's all about IT is not fast enough. So you have to move up the stack. And I think that's, for me, that's the most important thing, because I cover infrastructure in general now. Infrastructure have to move up the stack and be closer to the application people. Even if you don't do application people, closer to the, even if you don't have a lot of development in your shop, to the Cox application, work closely with them. So I think that's the best way to do that. Because if you just decide to do a network project by yourself, let's say you implement ACI by yourself and nobody cares, you have to break the silos and move up the stack.
Yeah, but the other problem, as Ed is pointing out, is that some enterprises are really running museums. They have so many solutions and legacy stuff and technical debt, and no one ever did a cleanup. And so whenever you want to introduce something new, you are quickly forced to support all the old stuff, and then you're back to square one. So how do you start simplifying and standardizing the infrastructure, and how do you ever get rid of the old stuff?
Yeah, so the phrase I use for that is legacy runs the world. For all the whiz bang talk about new technologies and PowerPoint, a vast majority, and I get that all the time from our clients, is that they have infrastructures that they can't apply this. And my point to that is you have to have this mentality of draw a line in the sand and build in new pods and new environments. And sure, there's going to be ties into the existing middleware, but you have to limit and control that. And from a organizational perspective, we've actually run a model. We did research about shifting the spend from premium products to premium people to kind of help facilitate this. But our model shows that if you purposely move to a more scale out, open commodity type of infrastructure, and you invest the savings into your people and you pay your people more money per capita, the overall spend on IT becomes 25-28% less over 5 years. So in terms of how do you convince the business to do this, there's that vehicle to do it. But this is not easy. This is not something you can do one day. But at almost every organization I speak to, there are new apps being put in every day, and some component of those new apps is not going to require the full octopus connectivity into the existing legacy. Sure, there's going to need to be some calls, but it's for those new initiatives, whether it's a VDI, maybe it's big data, maybe it's some modeling or analytics application. That's where you start implementing some of these principles.
Yeah, you almost have to create a new pod and operate it differently. And then maybe have a plan to move your existing network in that pod in the future, or just keep it on the side in some case. It's almost impossible to do. Let's say you have a classical three-tier network and you cannot move it, and you have mainframes and AIX servers and all kind of stuff. I mean, there's not really any value of moving that into a new automated system. You can leave it as is. And that's what the bimodal thing is all about, is you have the IP for innovation, and then you have the IP for stability, or the IP for agility. What's need to be agile? Because I think the business understands agility. You have to sell them agility. And you said this, if you want something agile, we need to move there. So now there's a problem, obviously, is you have to do your old job. you have to convince them that you have to spend some amount of time in that space. And that's where the culture again comes in. I cannot create that new pod, this new type of network while doing my old job, because I already worked 70 hours a week. I'm not going to, you know, now I'm not going to sleep anymore. So you definitely need to convince them that you need some resource to be able to do that.
Most network engineers don't sleep that much anyway, so.
Anyway, you mentioned premium people. And the usual problem I see out there is, how do you find them?
How do you keep them?
Yeah, well, in many cases, for many organizations, I think Simone referred to this earlier, is you might be able to find them, but can you convince them to come to your organization? So a lot of it is, if you're trying to find them and bring them in, that might not even be the right mentality, Yvonne. The mentality might be to grow your existing, to invest in your existing people. And I'm not talking about taking network engineers and turning them into programmers. I'm talking about taking people with network skill sets and broadening them so that they can get into Python and do some damage, be able to look at an API from a vendor and figure out whether it does what they need it to do, whether it's well documented, reverse compatible with previous versions. Does it authenticate properly? These are the skills and automation, whether it's Puppet, Chef, or Ansible. These are the skills that we need to evolve our current folks from, versus necessarily going out and hiring a guy who worked at one of the web scalers who's proficient in automation at scale. So I think it's a combination, not just of bringing external talent in, but of cultivating your existing staff to grow their existing skill set. And again, contrary to a lot of what's out there, to me, that doesn't mean your network team has to become programmers, but they do have to be more programmatic with their skill set.
And they have to move up that stack. So moving up that stack, getting closer to the application and breaking silos is always important. And it should have started with VMware. I was hoping that around 2010, that network engineers would be starting to learn more and more about VMware, but I realized that it didn't happen in a lot of places, because you were able to run VMware and use a vSwitch and all defaults and nothing else happened. You know, the network people didn't want to touch it, and the server people didn't want to touch it. So it was a no man's land, you know, the virtual access layer. Now, if you go with tools like NSX, that's not the case anymore, but this is a good example where the network teams needs to know a little bit more about the rest of the infrastructure. You push towards a team like that would manage, for example, the old, what they call the software-defined data center, for example, in VMware. So that would make a nice way to start. So they would know a little bit of servers, like what they call the full stack engineer, a little bit of server, a little bit of storage, a lot of networking, virtualization, and then starting to think about application.
Simone, you make a good point. When I talk to organizations that have done a relatively good job of integrating some of the teams, a very common thread from that small percentage of folks is at that vSwitch layer, right? Because the vast majority of enterprise, when you say who manages your vSwitch, it's the server team, and who manages your network, and, you know, starting at the top of rack, it's the network team, and there's very delineated responsibilities there. But for the folks who've integrated well, that vSwitch is generally the point where they start to blend and blur those teams. And it's usually network team starts with read-only access and understands how to set up port groups. And then it kind of extends to the server team having read-only access into the top of rack. So you bring up a great point that, you know, while it never happened the way kind of it should have, where the vSwitch is just another switch, and the network team managed switches, why they didn't get it. It does present an opportunity to help blend and blur some of those silos and do some cross-pollination and training and better integrate the teams within most mainstream enterprise, because that is an area where there is often a stark demarcation. And frankly, there doesn't need to be one.
And by the way, Michael made a cynical comment on exactly this topic, saying that in many enterprises, it's like this. This is my silo. There are many like it, but this one is mine. Don't touch it.
Yeah, I believe that's an old saying from the military about the rifle. The challenge with the siloism is that if you maximize each individual silo, very likely you're not maximizing the whole IT infrastructure as an entity supporting the business.
The other thing you mentioned, and I totally agree with, is you need to involve the networking people in DevOps and hopefully very early on, not the last Friday evening. How do you manage to do it?
In fact, it's even more than sometimes the networking people. It's the whole IT, the whole infrastructure and operation has to be involved in DevOps. Because you see in a lot of enterprise organization, you start a DevOps project and there's a DevOps guy that does infrastructure and they don't even talk to infrastructure. So I think what needs to happen for because I get a lot of call. I'm in operations, I'm an in-person architect, and we want to make sure that I'm a pure operation director or VP. I want to be relevant in mode two. I want to be relevant for the digital business or even in the cloud. What do I do? One thing they could do, and one thing we suggest, why don't you own the DevOps tools? So the whole suite of DevOps tools, you need to provide that as a service. Get involved. Create infrastructure to help the DevOps team so they don't have to do the ops by themselves. They don't have to do the infrastructure part of DevOps. And help them create tests. Help them for the pure provisioning of system. They need help in there. That's not what they really want to do. So integrate with them to provide infrastructure part of DevOps and everyone would be happy. But you need to, as an infrastructure person, whatever it's network or servers, you have to jump in there as soon as you can. If not, they'll do it by themselves. They might even hire someone else. They'll be in a different team. It'll be the DevOps team. That won't work. So you need to be able to, again, you have to provide value. It cannot be, now we're DevOps, but we have to wait for the network. Then you have to jump, provide value as soon as possible. And that's not easy. It's a cultural thing. It's, again, breaking silos and so on. We're basically talking about the same thing.
Yeah, but you also mentioned the problem of risk. And if we look at all these web scale companies, they look at failure as an opportunity to learn, whereas in many enterprises, failure is an opportunity to polish your resume. So how do we get from that enterprise mentality, we have to fire someone if something fails, to let's hope we learn because something fails?
Yeah, you're spot on. And that's why we have this topic that we focus on, which is rethinking downtime. Because again, you're right. This is all rooted in you get fired for causing outages. Or maybe you don't get fired, but maybe you get a note on your review or something. And again, this has prompted a culture of risk aversion. And again, preference for incremental, safer changes or changes that are perceived as safer. But again, this does actually create problems because long periods of stability inherently masks fragility and it makes people unprepared to deal with failure. So we have to rethink how we behave around downtime. And I think Simone said it earlier. We need to get into this mentality of fail fast, fail small. So we need to have more windows where we're making changes versus that monthly, weekend, middle of the night, big bang maintenance window that never goes well. I mean, never goes well. I've yet to talk to an organization or been a part of one where there's this big bang maintenance window where you're doing six things at Sunday at 2 a.m. and everything goes according to plan. So we have to break it into smaller pieces. We have to manage the change management aspect of that and explain how we're doing things differently. And again, you're absolutely right. We have to address the cultural aspect. We have to get into this DevOps mindset of blameless postmortems. Right. We need to learn from outage versus hide from them. So, build smaller failure domains, avoid these big layer two domains. And this is not something you can do overnight. A lot of this is going to be line in the sand as we deploy new infrastructure. Some of it you're going to be able to bring into your existing, but build out in pods because a larger surface area is fundamentally an issue for minimizing the collateral damage of an event. Right. We talk about this. And I know, Yvonne, you're very, very big on VLAN stretching and pointing out the challenges of it. And one of the primary reasons that you're against it is you extend the surface area of a potential failure domain. So we have to get smaller failure domains, think more changes in smaller versus big bang maintenance windows, and you end up with this result of fail fast, fail small. You get more rehearsed at troubleshooting. And again, it takes culture change. It takes how you measure people. It shouldn't just be about mean time, overall uptime. It should be about mean time to detect. And so it's very much a culture of people and a process technology.
There's a lot of technology lately that helps doing that. Obviously, network virtualization does that. A few other network virtualization solutions. So in theory, you barely touch. You have a spine-deep network layer tree, which you don't. It's very stable. You don't really touch it. And then you do most of your change in a virtual network space. So that helps, and you can do some isolation there. And then you also have emerging tools that does intent verifications, like emerging vendors, like Veriflow or Forward Network, where you basically model your network using very sophisticated algorithms, and you can do some what-if analysis. So they have a real view of your network and all its possible flow. And you can use these tools. So what happened if I do this? What happened if I do that? The old DevOps way also, part of the continuous integration of DevOps, you do automating testing. So when we do remember when I was a network engineers and did change at midnight on Saturday, there was no way we could test all the application. We had a bunch of tests. It was like a checkbox. We didn't automate testing. So there was always something missing. In fact, once we did all kind of testing and we couldn't fix it, we forgot it was a pure wire on the wrong port. And that I'm sure that happened to everyone. Plug the cable in the wrong port of a server. If you have automated testing that tests the easy thing as well as the more sophisticated thing, and that's part of CI, the continuous testing of continuous integration, that will help a lot. There's tools and new process that helps you move faster.
Yeah. And one thing I'll add is there is still some what I would call old school blocking and tackling that you have to do with networking. We're focusing on kind of what's new and some of these new anti-fragile practices, but there's a large percentage of mainstream enterprise network teams that don't do kind of the old school good best practices stuff. Things like having a configuration template and checking that your active as-built configs are against it. So using things like rollback and preparing rollbacks before you go into a change, these are all best practices that have been around for a decade plus that just aren't widely implemented. So we still have to do those things. The lack of automation in enterprise networking is shocking. And we did a survey last summer and we asked a VP of I&O, I think the sample size was a couple of hundred, what percentage of the changes in the data center are manual versus automated? And the mean was that 18% of network changes in the data center were automated. 18. So that means 82% are manual. In addition to, again, all this anti-fragile stuff, there is room to improve just in the basic blocking, tackling of how we manage networks, which is have a template, automate your basic config changes, check them against that template, use automation, use rollback to quickly recover. And again, these are practices that are known but not widely implemented across all organizations. And it's good to point out not to forget to do that stuff as you're moving forward with some of these newer principles.
Last year, I gave a talk in Las Vegas on network automation, and I talked about advanced stuff like OpenConfig and SDN, even intent-based networking. And I was talking about new stuff, and all my question was about change management. So people listened to that, yes, 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 but what about change management? That was most of my questions about that talk. So it, I found kind of a little bit demoralizing, but I really understand that. Okay, we talk about all that new stuff, but meanwhile, people have real problems, and some of them is they can't even get a change window. But there's all these cultural, organizational problems that don't help. And one thing I always tell people, it's not only the engineer. People think that one of the reasons the network is slow is because the network engineers are risk averse. Sometimes, most of the time, those silos are not created by the engineers. A lot of engineers, they want to move faster. People think, a network engineer, they say no to everything. That's not true. It comes from the top. Most of the network engineers are ready to change. They're willing to change. They're willing to move forward, become to modernize, and they cannot do it. There's too many processes in the company that blocks them. And sometimes it goes all the way to the VP of infrastructure, most of the time.
We continued our discussion for well over another half hour. You will hear that part in the next episode of Software Gone Wild. In the meantime, explore the other content available in the online course at ibspace.net/DC.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Software Gone Wild. If you want to learn more about software-defined networking, network automation, and related topics, visit sdn.ipspace.net and explore our courses, books, webinars, and podcasts.